This episode references eating disorders, fat phobia, and body dysmorphia. Listener discretion is advised. If you do feel affected by the topics we cover, check out the show notes for helpful resources and information.
I'm currently in a really weird place because you know that whole thing about your goal weight that everyone wants? Well, mine's probably going to kill me. I currently weigh 69 pounds, and honestly, I'd like to weigh even less than I do. I know in my head that, like, could kill me, but I'd really love to lose, like, 10 more pounds, even though I'm 5'7".
This is You Don't Know Me. I'm Chloe Combe. In today's episode, we're discussing a topic so deeply embedded in the lives of today's teenagers, the ones they live offline and the ones they perform online. It's the topic that came up, without fail, in the conversations I had with each young person in the making of this podcast, and I spoke to hundreds. It was body image. A recent survey by the Mental Health Foundation found that a third of British teenagers feel ashamed of their bodies. And it gets worse. Over in the States, 53% of 13-year-old girls were unhappy with their bodies, and it grows to a whopping 78% by the time they are 17. I want to say, before we begin, that this episode directly explores the role of social media on teenagers' perception of their bodies and self-esteem. It's a portion of the discussion, and by no means the full extent or the only way in which body image issues manifest. The story you're about to listen to is from Rachel. It was her voice you heard at the start of this episode. And as a result of pressures online, she fell victim to anorexia nervosa. I must warn you, this is not an easy listen.
Okay, Rachel, I'm recording. Are you ready to be recorded?
Yes.
Rachel is 16 years old. She lives in New Hampshire, USA, and she's been suffering with what she describes as weight issues since she was about 9 or 10.
I started developing really young and was totally self-conscious. I started my period 2 days before my 10th birthday and hated it. Like, everyone was kind of competitive. You know how girls are like about starting their period. But I was kind of embarrassed. So I hid mine until sixth grade, even from my mom.
God, okay.
I guess my big issue is that my mom and sisters are all kind of big, and food is kind of like a big deal in our house. I wouldn't say we're rich, but we're not poor, and food is everywhere in our house. And like the worst kind of food, pizza, chips, chocolates, candy, cheese, soda. I guess we were always rewarded with food and celebrated with food. And like, when people die or get married, we'd eat shitloads of food. I mean, we went to my great uncle's funeral and he'd just die of complications to do with diabetes, and everyone was stuffing their faces even though he pretty much just died of overeating. And the whole thing was a bit obscene, really.
She speaks about her eating disorder in a candid way that feels jarring, given the severity of her statements at times. Her frankness and her humour has me leaning in, as if there wasn't 4,000 miles between us. She goes on to tell me about how, while she didn't fit in at school,
I wasn't nerdy, I wasn't popular or pretty, but
she loved scrolling through Instagram.
I loved the Insta life. And they all had such perfect bodies, and so I decided to try this tea diet I think Khloe Kardashian was talking about. She had just lost loads of weight because she was always like the fat sister. I used my mom's credit card to buy it, and the tea didn't really work. It just made you go to the toilet a lot. But I guess it planted a seed, and I started to think slowly how to cut out food. At first, I got loads of compliments, and the girls at school were definitely nicer to me. And I was just getting better compliments. But everyone was just nicer to me about everything. You really start to notice that. The world hates fat people.
The world hates fat people. That phrase seems on the surface to be a terrible fatphobic observation. But she's actually not wrong. Fatness is still used as a punchline for loads of jokes, as an insult that's intended to devastate, and as a source of kind of morbid fascination, in the same way disabilities used to be for Victorian people visiting the circus.
So when did you think the weight loss became a problem? When did it start to become a problem?
I don't know. I didn't think it was a massive problem. But my eighth grade, I guess it got out of hand. I had a good list and a bad food list. And I would eat food on the good list and wouldn't eat food on the bad list. And the bad list just got longer and longer. At first, the bad list was just like pizza and cookies and stuff. But then I added a lot of other things to it, like bread and cereal. And then I added most fruit except melons, because melons are just water. But then I started to get freaked out by water, because I read somewhere that water makes you gain weight, you know, water weight. So I just tried to chew gum all day and not drink too much water. And I guess that's when everything really all went wrong. I hadn't drunk much all day and I just collapsed in one of my classes.
God.
I just want to take a moment here to introduce Deanne Jade. Deanne is the founder of the National Centre for Eating Disorders and has 35 years' experience in the field.
When I started this work, nobody had even heard of an eating disorder.
Sure, yeah.
It wasn't known, and there wasn't an internet. We're talking about 1983, before anyone had a mobile phone. In the past 5 years, we have been overwhelmed by calls for help from people and their carers as well.
Eating disorders are not new at all. There were many recorded cases of what we'd understand now to be anorexia nervosa in the Victorian era, with middle and upper class girls and their doctors praising the benefits of starvation highs. When Deanne Jade started practicing in the early 80s, there wasn't the sophisticated understanding or lexicon to name them all. So what's different now in the 20s? What we know about eating disorders is ever-evolving, but the immediately obvious difference is eating disorders have become, in a bitter twist of irony, a lot more inclusive. Whereas once the majority of sufferers were middle-class and up white girls, according to the NHS data, eating disorder admissions have gone up by 53% since 2017 among ethnic minorities. I believe that as media and social media, something all teens consume, has become more inclusive, featuring far more men, women of colour and non-cis people, those groups have a plethora of aspirational images to live up to and feel inadequate next to. And this has made them exponentially more vulnerable to body anxiety and the symptoms of that, eating disorders. Deanne and I spoke about a huge range of topics to do with disordered eating, and I told her about Rachel's story. To begin with, I wanted to know her thoughts on Rachel's categorisation of food.
Could you help me understand what the pathology behind the sorting of good food and bad food is for eating disorder sufferers?
This is called black and white thinking, and it's very common among eating disorder sufferers. Is usually a reflection of something much deeper, which is beliefs we have about ourselves. And those beliefs are unspoken and sometimes unknown because we don't know they're there. And an example is, unless I'm perfect, I failed. The sorting of foods into good and bad is what we call a symptom. And usually it starts well before someone thinks it has. People with anorexia, what they tend to have in common, because I hate to generalize, because everybody's different, is what I call the evil trio. The evil trio is nothing too pathological. It's being highly sensitive, very anxious, and also a perfectionist. We think that anorexia starts years before the symptoms show up, with someone who feels just on the edge of coping as children. And it's when you enter this period of uncertainty that you feel that your control is failing, and you can't keep up with the demands. And so the anxiety spirals, and the way that you get to feel safe is to start showing the symptoms of anorexia, which is shaving down your foods, moving into good and bad ways of exercising, ways of eating, and that we call the symptom, not the cause. Does that make sense?
I'd never looked at it this way. There's no doubt that Rachel certainly did feel the need to be in control and perfect when it came to food. Compliments from girls at school were the praise she needed to affirm that she had ownership of her disease and was achieving perfection. Returning to Rachel's story, she told me about how, after collapsing at school, the school started to get involved. She hated this.
Everyone had just been sort of freaking out at school prior to that. Not so much at home, because everyone there had their own problems, which I can't really talk about. Okay. And I didn't think anyone really noticed that much. But people were really freaking out at school, like telling me I was too skinny, and our gym teacher kept trying to corner me, and I dodged her. But when I collapsed, it was a major stress, because then I had to go see a doctor, and then it became everyone's problem, which was a big hassle, because that's when I had to start getting creative.
How so?
Because, like, your eating suddenly becomes everyone's business, and everyone is trying to stuff you, and I was like the Sherlock. I love Sherlock Holmes TV. Of food. I stayed ahead of everyone. I'd hide food in my shoes and my cheeks and my pockets and my bra behind curtains. I'd chuck food out windows and hide it in drinking cups and pretend to spill stuff down myself so I could run to the kitchen and throw it all out and spit it out. I did try throwing up food, but then I felt like that was cheating. By that point, it was just kind of like a game I wanted to win.
Yeah.
And the food was the enemy, but so were other people. And I guess I was just kind of like a bitch. At one point, my mom sent me to live with my grandmother, and that was so good because she's kind of old and didn't really get what was going on. So I managed to lose like nearly 20 pounds in 3 weeks. And that's how I ended up in the hospital. The school did like an intervention, and it was like a medical one like they do for addicts. And they made me go because I was a minor. I was so mad. But in a way, I did see I had a problem, because all of my hair was falling out. And I knew I was pretty sick, but not sick enough to stop. I think my goal weight just kept changing, and it got harder and harder to stop. Honestly, I love being able to see my hip bones when I stand up and feel all my ribs, but people do stare at you.
As I was speaking to Deanne, it became clear to me that when Rachel was sent to live with her grandmother, this became the perfect environment for her eating disorder to spiral completely out of control. Her grandmother's lack of awareness enabled Rachel's illness to take over. Deanne compared Rachel's relationship with her disorder at this point as similar to an all-consuming, toxic friendship.
And then, instead of just living authentically and honestly, they start figuring out how to please that toxic person so that that toxic person won't abuse them. And it's exactly the same with anorexia.
First, people would ask me how I got so slim, and you could tell they were jealous, because there's a lot of fat people in this country, which is kind of gross. Like, seeing fat on people really scares me, because I'm worried I'll catch it. Okay. Like, I know it's irrational, but it's true. I think people should start eating in front of a mirror, and I doubt anyone would be fat anymore, because it's just so gross to watch.
She's right. It sounded irrational, but that made me realise how intrusive these thoughts truly are. Rachel's disorder convinced her that eating, a biological human function, was repulsive.
But yeah, about a year ago, people made a lot of comments. Like, people would offer me food or tell me I should be eating or in the hospital all the time. Sometimes that would please me, like I was doing something right, you know?
Mm.
But I haven't been outside for a while. At first, because it was so cold in the winter and people were worried I would die of cold, which was stupid. But before I was hospitalized, I was struggling to do my exercises. I did think I was a bit weak, but I still went out every day, even though everyone would scream at me and try to stop me.
As she's telling me this, I get the impression that people's reactions just pissed her off. It feels like she's simply not as concerned about her own health as other people are.
A good therapist will never, ever threaten someone with anorexia and say, oh, you're hurting yourself, you'll feel better if you eat, or you're ill and you'll die, because in some senses, you're right. That shows that they want to be thin, they mean to be thin, and it's working. And for some people, threatening them with a tube is a sign that it's really working. You know, they envy people who are put on tubes because it proves that they're stronger than me. And if I'm not as thin as them, I'm fat. They also have a voice in their head. Anorexia is characterized by a voice which comes in, which pats them on the back if they're losing a bit of weight. They never aspire to be a particular weight. They just aspire to be thinner.
Sounds familiar, doesn't it? At the start of this episode, Rachel told me that she knew her goal weight would probably kill her, but she just wanted to lose an extra 10 pounds. While Rachel's story is an extreme one, it got me thinking about how commonly used this phrase goal weight can be. It seems every single teenager I've spoken to about body image has had a goal weight, and with it a sense that if they shed that weight, they will gain happiness. The goal and the method are completely unrelatable and unachievable, but it's almost impossible to rationalise this when these teens are so fixated on the so-called perfection. I wish I could tell you Rachel's story has a happy ending, that she recovers and goes on to be healthy and happy, but I can't, because Rachel's story is still unfolding. My conversation with her took place over Zoom. I was in my home in England. Rachel is speaking to me from a recovery facility. She's hospitalised with her disorder. And how does she feel about that?
It sucks. You're watched like a hawk every minute of every day, and you have almost no privacy and very little dignity. You're weighed multiple times a day, and you're not allowed to wear proper clothes because of hiding stuff. Not even gowns or pajamas with pockets, no onesies, because you can hide stuff more easily. You get searched, weighed, and you get loads of therapy where you have to talk constantly about all kinds of personal stuff, which honestly I don't think has anything to do with anything. You're not allowed a phone or a laptop unless you reach a certain weight goal. And at first you're not allowed any visitors because they don't want you having any stress at all. It just makes us upset. Like, we're in prison. Even when you can use your phone, social media and lots of sites are banned because they don't want you looking at Finspo.
Is that when you look at very thin pictures and kind of get inspired? That's right?
Yes, it's okay. Like that, yes. And no one is allowed to go to the toilet unsupervised. And if you get out of bed, you're always chaperoned, especially the girls with bulimia. I have an IV drip and 4 meals and snacks. It's awful, awful, awful. I can't even describe how stressful it is to be force-fed like a fucking farm animal. But I do want to get out.
I was really conscious of making sure our exchange was a positive one and not one that would cause stress to Rachel. So I promised I'd only keep her for 20 minutes if she felt comfortable. For my final question, I asked her if, when she's out of hospital, she thought she'd carry on with her recovery.
That's hard because I do want to get better. And I don't want people to be upset all the time. But food for me feels like an enemy and poison. I don't want it in my body.
I found myself so conflicted as I tried to empathize with Rachel while trying to rationalize her situation in my own head. Her circumstance, while extreme, is not uncommon. Anorexia remains the most fatal of any psychiatric disorder globally. Exact global stats on eating disorders are tricky because they are by their nature very secretive diseases that people are often slow or unwilling to get help with, particularly in the case of bulimia, which can be harder to detect. There are also those that don't fit neatly into the more well-known forms of eating disorders. Around 40% of diagnoses are classified as EDNOS, eating disorder not specified, and this trend is being fueled by social media and the online world. Something I couldn't ignore throughout was Rachel's references to things like inspo and clean eating that she'd seen all over social media. I asked Deanne to explain what impact she'd observed social media to have on eating disorder sufferers over the years.
Social media has had a huge effect on how people see themselves of all ages. For adolescents, it's a time when their self-confidence tends to be at their minimum. As we grow older, we always get a little bit more solid about who we are. And their body security is at its lowest. Psychologists call it body schemacity or appearance schemacity, how important appearance is. It's important through the lifespan, but in adolescence, very much so. So, you know, the question is, how does social media affect that? And the answer has to be hugely. Adolescents are very, very easily influenced by influencers and what I've seen. And my colleagues have seen is, sadly, a huge upsurge in body insecurity, poor body image, and that's against a background of poor mental health.
In this context, I describe social media as something resembling a Trojan horse. At first scroll, we're presented with toned, tanned tummies, positioned into back-breaking poses and huge, cosmetically whitened smiles to match. But what looks on the surface to be a positive influence can spiral into obsessive comparison and taking the lessons of online personas as gospel. I'm not saying these influences are all at fault. Many are actually qualified nutritionists or personal trainers who enjoy sharing their knowledge and lifestyle and often find community and companionship in their online followers. But the term healthy can become warped. There's no guarantee and little oversight to ensure that all those following will be able to consume the content of their favourite clean eating guru with a rational perspective.
Hi!
Hi!
We meet at last after this. So thank you so much for agreeing to do this.
Thank you for having me.
That's Maria. She's 16 and she's from the south of England. Maria is on the other side of an all-consuming addiction to the clean eating messages on social media. Those messages drove Maria to suffer extreme orthorexia, an eating disorder that involves an obsession with healthy eating. Unlike anorexia, which is about the quantity of food consumed, orthorexia centres around the quality of food consumed. Like Rachel, Maria had to undergo therapy to recover from her disorder. We began talking about the troubling perfection shown on social media and the contrast to real life.
I think the first thing that comes to mind when you mention that is the idea of obviously body image and more specifically body dysmorphia, because I'm sure that's something you've heard of.
Tell me about that.
It's just the idea that you think you look a certain way, which isn't true. You may have a fixation on certain features, like your nose or your jawbone, or you may think that everyone always stares at you. You know, it's a preoccupation with your appearance that isn't based in reality.
Have you had an experience of body dysmorphia?
Well, my experience of body dysmorphia was a little bit outside the norm, because even though I was suffering from anorexia nervosa, a restrictive eating disorder, I didn't have the typical body image dysmorphia, which is thinking I'm overweight or fat or don't deserve to eat. I had a very odd sort of fixation that I don't think is talked about enough, that I looked ill all the time. And I did look ill because I was thin, but even before then, I was too thin, I was underweight. But even before then, I thought I had black rings under my eyes. I thought I was faint. I thought I looked pale and sick and tired. And I just couldn't shake that feeling. I thought everyone was staring at me all the time and they thought I was contagious.
So what triggered that obsession with this sort of aspect of your looks?
I mean, it's hard to say. There are a million different factors that can trigger it, you know, genetics, upbringing, socioeconomic situations. But I can definitely say that part of what triggered it was just looking at Instagram. So I would look at people with glowing skin and, you know, drinking green smoothies all the time and this sort of ideal of wellness and fitness. And I just didn't think I fit it at all.
Can I just say that all eating disorder professionals, all of us, are very, very hostile to the clean eating trend. It won't turn everyone into an anorexic, the clean eating fad. It certainly helps an anorexic justify and therefore maintain behavior that's very toxic, so that many anorexics, when they are recovering, cannot get out of clean eating thinking. And that impedes their recovery. With other people, with other young people, what saddens me is that the clean eating trend means that they malnourish themselves. And they start feeling like bad people if they eat a food which isn't clean.
Maria is a perfect illustration of Deanne Jade's observation. Clean eating became her way of coping with body dysmorphia.
I got quite fixated on things like the amount of macronutrients I was eating or the amount of vegetables I was eating. And I believe that dairy, carbs, sugar, all the sort of usual enemies were the source of my unhappiness and my preoccupation with my body and appearance, which they obviously weren't. So that's what I did. Yeah, and I ended up losing a lot of weight and developing a restrictive eating disorder. My orthorexia started with sort of, which I can't blame it, I think it's a wonderful thing. I'm a eco-justice warrior, but it started with veganism, you know, obviously to encourage people to help the environment and go vegan. People do demonize dairy products. They do demonize animal products, fats. And I think once you fixate on one item of food, on one food group, it's hard to stop and it just spreads.
And how does the psychology of that work in your brain and in your sort of psyche and emotions?
The thing about restricting food is your prefrontal cortex, if I'm going to get very specific with it, starts to recognise the restriction with short-term relief as something that takes stress away, brings you a really sense of achievement and pride and comfort. So once you start doing that with one thing, you look at something else and it's almost like an addiction. I always say to people, eating disorders are like addictions because you're always looking for that next, what else can I do to make myself feel prouder and better and prettier? So you've got to constantly battle that. It's a constant battle and it's not just people with eating disorders that suffer from it. You've got to be aware of your thoughts and behaviours around food and exercise and constantly fight against them and reframe them.
Do you think that the online world is creating almost like an orthorexic competitiveness?
So I would get sent challenges from my followers or from people who I followed, and it would be things like go a week without, you know, eating dairy, or go a week with just eating this certain food group, and then I would achieve it, feel proud of myself, document it and send it to others.
Wow.
Not just with food, with exercise, with revision, with anything that can become compulsive. There are challenges, plethora of challenges online that make you feel like it's a good thing.
Elements of Maria's account felt really relatable. For most of us, barely a day goes by when we don't think of our bodies or our eating or our lifestyles in some sort of judgmental way. As Maria says, there are so many areas of life we can try to control. Perhaps we declare war on our bodies because what goes into them is entirely up to us. Maria told me how her thousands of followers would spur her on. I asked her to give me an example of how that relationship with her audience would play out.
Part of my recovery was definitely absolutely isolating myself from that world and cutting it off. So I recommend that to anyone else so I don't have something in front of me. But what I can recall is it's a new phenomenon because things that I was very aware of are things like pro-anorexia sites. And these are things I'm told about at school and warned about. But what you're not warned about and what is actually promoted in schools is things like healthy eating and exercise. So even things like God, I can't remember the name, but there's, you know, even healthy eating apps that I've been recommended at school, I've formed a group with people online, and you can form like a text sort of support group almost, but obviously it's not supportive. So people would be texting you going, oh my gosh, I've been so naughty or so bad today. I've cheated on this diet. I've eaten this. I feel disgusting. I feel horrible. And this is the norm. Like, don't think that this is some horrible dark web world of eating disorders. It's not. If you, all you have to do is scroll through the comments in their NHS Health Instagram, and you'll see it there. And it's praised almost. It's like, yes, hate yourself. Yes, feel guilty.
I can imagine Maria's cutting herself off from the world in order to recover was a really difficult decision. It's a brave move to sever ties with the thousands of voices which validate you. Social media for most of us is a bit like the classic frenemy, a friend we've all had, who we probably loved, admired, even envied, but who was also pretty toxic. It's why, and I say this to every teenager or parent I talk to, every school I visit, that we, and especially young people, need to balance their social media lives with their IRLs. The last place where everything is not airbrushed into a different existence, and we can't fake absolutely everything. I've interviewed a lot of teenagers from all kinds of backgrounds. And the one thing that hurts me so much about the obsession with body image, and at worst, suffering eating disorders, is all the loss. You lose so much. You lose fun, experiences with friends, first kisses, hobbies, school, university, first loves, and most importantly, time. Precious teenage and young adult years you will never get back. If you are, you know, or you love someone who is suffering from an eating disorder, please reach out. You deserve help. You deserve to be happy. You deserve the you that doesn't belong to an eating disorder. There'll be many people listening whose lives are untouched by illnesses like Rachel's and Maria's, but who still have a difficult or challenging relationship with their body image. In fact, I'd wager there aren't many people listening who've never thought, even fleetingly, they wish they could change this or look like X. It would be impractical to suggest anyone can ever really get away from the tyranny of body image and online perfectionism. But after all these conversations with teens, I do have two suggestions. One, always, always ask who you're improving for. And is it really making you happy? Secondly, remind yourself, your mates, your kids, that social media is a fantasy where we're all thinner, smoother, have bigger boobs, pecs and butts, and look happier, sexier or richer. It's clear that this is a generation addicted to the fantasy. They've grown up online, documenting their physical evolution along the way. But considering how much depression, anxiety, and mental health disorders are rising in young people as a direct consequence of social media and its unrealistic demands, is this a risk and rite of passage they must endure to discover that the fantasy really isn't worth it? This is a Podimo podcast by Mermaid. I'm Chloe Comby, my producer is Rihanna Coleman, and our audio engineer is John Scott, and we've had production support from Jilly Archer. As always, I'm so keen to hear from you, our listener, on what you thought of this episode. If you think we've missed anything or would like to share your own experiences, the inbox is always open for your voice notes. The email to send them to is chloe@hellomermaid.com. It's in the show notes too, if you're after the spelling of that one. See you next week.